welcome to Little Atoms. Little Atoms is a show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism and liberal democracy. These ideas find their opposite in superstition, in religious fundamentalism, fanaticism, medievalism, totalitarianism, censorship and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Our guest today is Linda Grant, and just before I hand over to Neil, who's going to introduce Linda, I'll just point out that I looked at the not entirely reliable internet resource, looked you up, Linda, and it told me that Linda Grant has written more about Dior than anything else and a lot about Burberry in the last month.
I've never written anything about Burberry.
She's probably taken
but I have written about Dior.
Linda's probably taken one look at her two interviews today and realised she's unlikely to be asked about either of those subjects. So, Neil.
Thanks, Richard. Linda Grant is a journalist and author, previously a feature writer on The Guardian and the columnist for the Jewish Chronicle. Her first novel, The Cast Iron Shore, won the David Higham First Novel Prize and was shortlisted for the Guardian Fiction Prize. Her second novel, When I Lived in Modern Times, won the Orange Prize for Fiction. Her next novel, Still Here, was longlisted for the Man Booker Prize. She's also the author of Sex in the Millennium, A Political History of the Sexual Revolution, The People on the Street, A Writer's View of Israel, and Remind Me Who I Am Again, a family memoir. Her latest book, The Clothes on Their Backs, is to be published at the beginning of February this year. So, Linda, thanks for joining us. And as the book hasn't actually come out yet, The Clothes on Their Backs, perhaps you'll begin by telling us what it's about.
Well, it's very, very loosely based on the figure of Peter Rachman that I think sort of, you know, most people I've met, you know, at least the name rings a bell. He was a slum landlord in the late 1950s, early 60s. He actually died in 1962. And one of his claims to fame is that he was mixed up in the Perfumer affair because he, both Christine Keener and Mandy Rice Davis were his mistresses. And the other interesting thing about him was that he was a Holocaust survivor, came to England in 1946. My novel is about a young woman who discovers that a figure, you know, like Rachman, a slum landlord, is her uncle. And she discovers this in 1977. And she becomes his amanuensis. She becomes his sort of Bosworth as he tries to tell his story and to justify himself to her, to win her over. And it's set during the period of the rise of the National Front and the Anti-Nazi League. And it's really trying to address some very complicated questions, one of which I think has sort of, you know, hung around for about the past 60 years, which is why does suffering not ennoble? You know, why do victims not become saints? And that's one of the questions that this book tries to address. And a kind of recurrent theme in it is the question of clothes. Not necessarily fashion, though fashion is certainly involved in it, but the clothes people wear and how they define them, how those clothes define them as individuals.
Well, you mentioned there the sort of idea of how does suffering not be noble? Mm. And obviously, you know, Sandor Kovacs, who is the character who is based on Rachman, is larger than life and sort of goes from sort of sympathetic to not sympathetic, depending on what he's sort of saying and what opinions are coming out and what he's doing. But although you portray him as you know, going through the labour camps and sort of suffering, which could almost give sympathy to him. Before that, he was a pimp working in Hungary. Yeah. Anyway, so was this deliberate to sort of paint?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because you know the idea that all kinds of people went into the camps. You know, pimps went in as well as sort of concert violinists and pianists. everyone went in, and the, you know, the core of his personality is that of survival, because he survives as others do not survive. And so the question, of course, you know, it's a very, very difficult question, is what do people have to do in order to survive? So I wanted to make him a man who was both, you know, I mean, I think the word sympathetic isn't really the right one. You know, he's very human, and he, you know, he desperately wishes to have something to go on into the future, and he wants it to be this, that his niece will have a good memory of him. And, you know, and he's, paradoxically, he's, you know, just about to get engaged to a black woman who has experienced her fair share of racism.
Well, obviously, Rackman was famous as being a slum landlord. Predominantly, his tenants were black. So, but how... Let's talk about that. I mean, clearly, that sort of... muddying the waters there a bit, isn't it, by introducing...
Well, Rackman was a very, very interesting and complicated figure. There was a biography of him in the mid-late 70s, which I read, I mean, long out of print. And I found him a very, very fascinating, interesting man, because unlike Sandor Kovacs, I mean, this is a man who really should have been a dentist in Lodz. You know, he came from a middle-class family, and he lost absolutely everything, and his health was really destroyed by the war. And by the time he arrived in England, you know, he really only had about 16 years left to live. I mean, he died at the age of 42. And there's a sort of, you know, I read something, one of the, you know, there's an interview in the Evening Standard after he died, and somebody, sort of, you know, very upper-class woman, said she'd seen him through a car window, and she said, you know, and I realised I was looking at the face of evil. And I thought, no, you weren't looking at the face of evil. You know, these moral absolutes, you know, in the case of somebody like him, are just preposterous. He was... you know, somebody who was a survivor, but he was also weak. He was boastful, but, you know, the conditions of his personality don't derive from evil; they derive from his personality.
The way you, as you just described, it was described as the face of evil, and how much of that do you think, as well as, or clearly, you know, for what he'd done, but how much of that do you also think comes out of the, you know, almost the sort of Fagin, like, Jewish idea in the popular imagination
time. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that when you kind of read, you read the accounts of him, there's certainly a tinge with anti-Semitism. And he was in a very peculiar position because he arrives as a refugee in 1946, and he has been brought up in a middle-class Jewish family in Poland, but the Poles don't accept him because he's Jewish. And then he goes to the Jewish community, and the Jewish community don't accept him because, as far as they're concerned, he's Polish. So he's kind of, you know, really betwixt and between. You know, he's sort of, you know, he's cut off from any kind of hinterland. And there were certainly strong elements of, you know, of anti-Semitism in the way he was regarded, because he never became a kind of fear, you know, sort of hero of popular legend, as the Krays did for a while in the 60s, because they had a manner, you know. I mean, they were part of a community, sort of white working class community.
Well, it's interesting that we're spending a lot of time now talking about Rackman rather than Sandor Kovacs, the character from the book. And obviously, you've based that character on a real-life character. And something
It was inspired by Rackman.
Sure.
You know, I wanted to write about a Rackman-like figure. And, you know, I mean, I've changed the biography greatly.
Well, the other sort of aspect of this I want to bring in is... going back, you know, onto your wider writing, not just the novels, but also... the novel People on the Street, the non-fiction book People on the Street. There's a very high aspect of autobiography to...
No, there isn't any. There's no autobiography.
You write about
things...
There
isn't any autobiography.
You write about things that, as I suppose all writers do, that... experiences that happen. I mean, a really trite example, having read The Clothes on Their Backs first, and I won't spoil the book for people who haven't read it yet, but there's a tragic incident that happens on a honeymoon.
Right.
Which then I read The People on the Street, and this is an incident
that's not really autobiography. I mean, that's, you know, autobiography is when you're really writing about your own life. But, you know, when you're writing a novel, you just kind of, you know, you're thinking, what should I do now? You know, you're looking at, you know, how could somebody die? And you think, okay, I'll I'll do that. You know, you're being a bit of a magpie. But, you know, autobiography, I think when you're writing something which feels autobiographical, I mean, these are just picking up incidents. I wouldn't call that autobiography at all.
Actually, you sort of ruined my question there. One of the things that I think is so great about the book is almost immediately from the very first chapter where Vivian goes and meets Sandor's partner.
Yeah,
almost immediately you portray the atmosphere and the smell and the dust in the air in the room, and this is what I thought was so powerful about it. And I was going to ask you if that's where that sort of comes from.
Which
well,
sort
just
of what?
Just you know
the atmosphere.
The atmosphere comes from being an autobiographical.
No, not in the slightest. I mean, it's
you're not telling me you're a novelist who uses your imagination.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that's what I'm saying. I mean, the opening chapter in the shop is probably. I mean, when I was a child, parents used to go to London, and they used to come back with kind of, you know, beautiful things, and you know, they always used to stay in this hotel at Marble Arch. So that whole sort of territory, which is incidentally where Christine Keeler had a flat, you know, had a kind of certain sort of 50s louche glamour to it. And, you know, I don't think I've ever actually been in one of those shops, but, you know, I've seen pictures of their interiors. So, no... not autobiographical at all.
Well, I was curious about something you were saying about the book being set in the 70s the rise of the rise of the National Front, but also the corresponding rise of the anti-Nazi League and the whole sort of anti-racist movement, which I think, would you say, won?
Oh, right. Just briefly, lest people think that this is autobiographical, I wasn't actually even living in Britain in 1977, and I came back for a visit in 88, and it was actually friends of mine who had been involved in the Anti-Nazi League and Rock Against Racism that I heard all this from, so certainly not autobiographical. Oh, I mean, I think the Anti-Nazi League did win. I mean, I think it won absolutely decisively. I think there'd
I
been
think it
two,
got a whole generation of people.
There've been two periods, you know. Well, actually, there've been really sort of three periods in the 20th century where the far right has tried to mobilise in Britain, and they've been defeated each time, and they've been defeated by mass mobilisation. And you say I wasn't around, but you know, there was an intention. Which, I mean, I backed away from to actually do a sort of whole scene during the Battle of Lewisham, which was in 77. And that was actually the reason for choosing 1977 as the year. But in the end, I didn't do it because it was sort of too journalistic, really. But, I mean, I think that... I mean, people say that the National Front were defeated by the election of Thatcher, but I think that they've always been defeated by mass mobilisation on the streets.
And it was... I think it was also made so unacceptable to be racist.
Yeah.
It was a feeling. Certainly, I mean, I was around in 77, I remember the concerts and the whole sort of the fact that so many young people were brought up with this feeling.
It
was so unacceptable.
I think it was. Well, first of all, I think it was very, very clever of the Anti-Nazi League to have the word Nazi in its title because it taps into, you know, Britain as the country which defeated fascism. So I think that, you know, that was really quite a significant thing because it was basically saying, you know, the Second World War, which kind of coloured all our lives, you know, which was cast this sort of huge shadow over the 1950s,
exactly.
And all those kind
still bomb sites.
That's right,
the
still
60s.
Bomb sites and those kind of, you know, all those sort of Saturday afternoon RAF films. It's basically saying, which side are you on? So I think it was very, very smart to play into this. But something that one has to remember that was going on at the time, which I think has now been almost completely forgotten, was that there was a sort of an element of punk which was certainly flirting with fascism, and it was certainly flirting with the symbols of fascism, specifically
Susie the Banshees wore a
with
a
the swastikas.
Sticker on her
that's
armband.
Right, and the sort of swastika chic was a very common phenomenon back in the late 70s. And I think that what things like Rock Against Racism did was they really nailed that one.
And they actually reminded people what it was all about.
That's right.
Which I think was,
that's right.
You know, it was a very important thing that they did.
Yeah.
And mentioning the whole, you know, the success, really, of the anti-racist movement at that period, it reminds me of the fact there was a similar rise at the time in the feminist movement. I mean, the feminist movement obviously started considerably before that, but the 70s was a powerful time for that.
It was very, very significant, partly because there had been a series of attempts to amend the 67 Abortion Act through private members' bills. And I remember kind of, you know, defeat the Corrie bill, defeat the, you know, whatever it was. There was always sort of, you know, any number of bills that you had to go and demonstrate against. And I think I probably demonstrated on pro-life marches, probably pro-choice marches, more than any others. And, you know, certainly women were very, very active in...
there was the Reclaim the Night.
Reclaim the Night. You know, there was some very, very important sort of, you know, street-level feminism going on at that time. And also sort of slightly later, what was sort of really the beginnings of what became town hall socialism and thus town hall feminism. You know, women, you know, suddenly, you know, all these ideas which you've been talking about in your kind of, you know, freezing cold student houses, you were talking about them in a kind of plush office in the GLC, you know.
But you wrote interestingly about this, I thought, quite recently, in that you were sort of comparing, well, how can I put this? You were saying that there's almost an uncomfortable relationship between feminism and the far left. Mm. And I wondered if you could expand a little on this, because I thought it was a fascinating article.
I really think that's happened over the past 2 or 3 years. I think it really comes out of the war in Afghanistan, more so than Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. I mean, clearly you only have to read about the Taliban and you realise, you know, what this was, you know. I mean, I've called Saudi Arabia, you know, apartheid for women, but this was far, far worse. And, you know, women had been campaigning about the Taliban all through the 90s. And I think that what happened was when the invasion of Afghanistan took place immediately after 9/11, and a lot of people were talking about, you know, women's rights, I think the left, parts of the left, and certainly the far left, really got cold feet, because what they were saying was that feminism was being used as a sort of pretext for liberal interventionism. And it was certainly true that, you know, the whole question of women's rights became a central part of the debate. But interestingly, what then started to happen was, you know, as I have pointed out, I don't think there's ever been any part of the women's movement which has been pro-war. It's very, very difficult. I mean, I think Phyllis Chesler in America, but there's never been a women's movement which has been advocated, you know, bombing countries to get their civil rights. But suddenly you had the far left saying you can't even raise the question of feminism, because in order to raise the question of women's rights, you are, you know, you're encouraging, you know, Donald Rumsfeld or whoever it what is, you know, you're encouraging the Americans to bomb. So please shut up about it. You can't even talk about women's rights. And then, of course, this, you know, this very, very dubious notion that, you know, that women's rights and feminism is basically a sort of Western imperialist notion. Ideologically, you know, whatever you do about it, it's a Western imperialist, you know, ideology. And
I just wonder where you end up if you start following.
Well,
that,
I mean, I, you know, I find it, you know, I find it very, very, very disturbing. And one of the reasons why I find it so disturbing is you think, well, you know, do we kind of, you know, march for years on end, go through, you know, and really kind of not physically put your life on the line, but undergoing profound social changes in the status of women, really fighting for that stuff, then to be told, well, actually, you were fighting for sort of, you know, Western imperialism. And, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't see Ronald Reagan, you know, on any of our demos. And I find it, you know, I find it really quite offensive. And I think it's a very, very tricky area. It's an extremely tricky area, because generally people don't like ideas forced on them, imposed on them from the outside. But I suppose what I feel is that there are enough crazy marginal figures.
And I suppose you never get
and you know people like Andrea Dworkin was a crazy marginal figure. And, you know, in the end, people realise she was right. But, you know, I mean, that's what I feel, that if you don't lend your support to these crazy marginal figures, you know, in Iran or so Saudi Arabia, you know.
And there's also this thing about, you know, well, we're imposing ideas on people.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. Nobody's actually asked them whether they want these ideas
sure.
or not.
Sure, yeah.
Well, yeah. I wanted to bring in that whole idea of sort of cultural relativism there, because there's... It's not even as far as saying, well, if you're talking to people in Iran, for instance, about these sort of ideas, that you're doing the work of the of you know the neocon Zionist entity or whatever. It's just the left seems to have lost its idea of internationalism, in that, you know, that you can show solidarity for the idea that you can show solidarity for people who are suffering in the third world. It's like, well, who are you to force your the ideas of the West on these?
Well,
people?
I think you can show solidarity to certain people in other parts of the world. I mean, I think you can show solidarity with people who are being oppressed by the Americans and the Israelis, but you can't show any solidarity to people who are being oppressed by their own government unless that government is supported by the Americans. You know, I mean, that's the sort of, you know, that's the thinking. But I mean, I suppose kind of, you know, Trotsky's idea of permanent revolution just sort of doesn't really exist anymore. There is a very interesting sort of merging between the far left and the non-interventionist right.
All right, well, let's go back to the writing. I'm sorry to sort of vaguely bring up the autobiographical idea again, but we had Howard Jacobson on the show a couple of weeks ago, and one of the ideas that came out from the discussion with him was, beyond the fact that, you know, he's a writer who happens to be Jewish, he was very keen on this idea of the Jewish writer as almost an idiom. And I wonder how you see your own work in relation to this.
Yeah, I think I probably don't really. I mean, I think, you know, the fact is that every one of my novels has had, you know, been about Jewish characters. But I think that's not so much an idiom as more a question of, you know, I think I would find it difficult to write about characters. I would be worried about sort of ventriloquism, and it is a kind of write about what you know. But I think that the way Howard writes is quite different from the way I write. And the thing about Howard's characters is that they're absolutely kind of rooted in, you know, in a certain, you know, in a time and a place. And I think that what has been true of all my characters is either they leave home to make a journey or they are forced home after a journey. So it's much more to do with... My novels, I think, are much more to do with a sense of displacement. Mm-hmm. Of people who feel that they have no home, of people who feel that they somehow don't have a place in the world, and are sort of, you know, merely the possessors of a passport, and so the sort of the parents of Vivian in this novel, who are refugees, who, you know, lived in London since their early 20s, since, you know, 1938, you know, absolutely refugees, you know, 40 years later, they're still refugees, they're living as refugees. And they have this sort of, you know, rather kind of pathetic gratitude to England, to this kind of, this very stereotyped idea of England, which they've constructed for themselves. And, you know, the idea of obedience to authority, which they absolutely adore, and keeping your head down and, you know, and being, you know, being a good citizen because of this kind of rather pathetic gratitude to this country, which has given them a home.
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left.
So maybe just to finish on a perhaps slightly more positive note, because I know you're a proud Liverpoolian.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
And Liverpool, as we probably all know, has just been made the City of Culture, the European City of Culture. And I wondered, what were your feelings when you heard that?
Absolute elation, absolutely fantastic. I'm really, really, really delighted. Because, you know, I really felt that Liverpool had been done an enormous disservice by Hatton and Militant. You know, what they had done was to create a mythology of the city which had no place in reality.
In
the hard industrial men. You know, I mean, right. Come on, there were no factories in Liverpool until after the war. You know, it's a seaport, commerce. You know, it's not an industrial. I mean, it was industrial for about 25 years. You know, the thing about capital of culture was that, you know, Liverpool had been, in a sense, trapped and enclosed. It's a seaport. It looks across the Atlantic. And the contraction of the docks and of shipping meant that Liverpool was just turned in, really like a sort of city in a cage. And what capital of culture did was to just bring an enormous amount of private investment into the city, which was exactly what it needed. And it's been a huge success.
Do you think it's also a chance for Liverpool to get away from some of the stereotypical...
I don't know what better word there is for it, but, I mean, they're racist, you know. Mm. I mean, it's demonisation, it's dehumanisation of a whole people just because of where they come from. And, you know, what is happening is that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are coming to Liverpool and seeing what an incredible place it is and coming away and saying, it's great, it's wonderful. Yeah.
I read a satirical website the other day. It claimed that a journalist had been sacked because he wrote an article about Liverpool which didn't mention the Beatles or football. I think we're at the end of the show. Linda, we haven't had a chance to talk about Burberry. Never mind, we'll do that if you're ever on again.
I've done nothing about Burberry.
It's been a great pleasure to have you on. Neil, who do we have next week?
Next week is Derek Pasquill.
Derek Pasquill, that's a bit of a scoop. You've been listening to Little Atoms with me, Richard Sanderson, with Neil Denny, and with our guest today, who is Linda Grant. Go out and read her books. Thanks for listening.